welcome back to the Hindu Studies channel of the New Books Network. I am your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. You can find out about me and my research at rajbalkaran.com. And for today's podcast, you're interviewing Shyam Ranganathan. Shyam is faculty member of the Department of Philosophy and a research associate at the York Center for Asian Research at York University in Toronto, Canada. And today we'll be talking about his book, Hinduism, Contemporary Philosophical Investigation. Welcome to the channel, Shyam.
Thanks, Raj. Happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you. You have produced a fascinating study that we will dive into. But before we dive into the study, how about we dive a bit into the author and tell us a bit about yourself and what it is you do?
Oh, okay. So I'm a philosopher primarily, and my areas of specialization are moral and political philosophy, translation theory. I used to think about that as largely an exercise in the philosophy of language. And so, you know, I do count that as an area of specialization, but I think about that more now as part of a project in the philosophy of thought. I'm also an accidental South Asianist. I decided to take a little break from, you know, what is conventional philosophy in the West, which is basically philosophy in the Western tradition, for an MA in South Asian studies. And that really informed a lot of my thinking about philosophical problems in the Western tradition, and also gave me some pointers on how we might solve them. And so when I started, I guess, a lot of my research that I'm still doing today, it was when I got interested in this apparent problem of the missing moral philosophy from the Indian tradition. And that was something I noticed was really bizarre as a graduate student, that it wasn't just that, you know, the big names or the common contributors to scholarship on Indian philosophy didn't talk about Indian ethics or moral philosophy, but there were these very famous pronouncements by people like Motilal that really there isn't really anything significant in the way of ethics or moral philosophy in Indian tradition. And so I thought that was just bizarre, and it struck me as strange, given that my own education as a philosophy undergrad, I had the strangest experience where my own South Asian background came alive in my ethics and moral philosophy classes, where these kinds of basic questions of how you would evaluate the rightness or wrongness of an action were front and center, and you know, I could in very broad strokes distinguish between, you know, deontological approaches that you would find the Gita versus consequentialist approaches you would find amongst Buddhists and Jains, who seem to kind of take this kind of very austere virtue theoretic approach. And then when I contrasted how my background came alive in the ethics classes with my philosophy of religion classes, I felt like, you know, nothing that we were talking about in philosophy of religion made any sense of, you know, my parents and my family's background, or even what was kind of broadly relevant to South Asian religion. And so when I came upon this rather strange view in the literature that, you know, Indians weren't interested in ethics, it just started off this kind of this snowball of research. Well, the first question is why, you know, why would anybody come to think that? And the first thing I noticed was that how Indologists study Indian thought didn't resemble anything like what would happen in philosophy, where, you know, as a philosophy student, you're encouraged to try and understand the theory of a thinker that would explain their controversial claims. So if you're going to study Kant, you have to try and understand Kant's theory of morality that would explain his use of the word morality. And you would do the same thing with, you know, utilitarians. You would try to understand their theory that would influence, the, you know, entail their claims that they make about ethics. And then you would understand the topic as what they disagree about. But what I found in Indology was that authors and commentators would use their own outlook as a way of gauging what Indian thinkers were saying. So they would look on a case-to-case basis and then measure out claims about Dharma, not in terms of a background theory that was informing what the Indian thinker was saying, but in terms of their own beliefs. So, you know, when the Buddhist uses the word dharma for what the Indologist would think is just a constituent of reality, all of a sudden, you know, the meaning there isn't ethics or morality, it's whatever the Indologist would have said. And so this struck me as bizarre. It was this kind of systematic displacement of, you know, Indian philosophical views with the kinds of views that contemporary Westernized thinkers would rather Indian thinkers said. And so when I went on to my my PhD research in translating moral discourse, it was largely a dissertation in analytic metaethics and philosophy of language, and also translation studies, but I also drew from continental thinkers. The weirdest kind of experience I had was I started to see that the kinds of things that happened in scholarship and Indology were just direct entailments from, you know, widely held views about language and translation in the Western tradition. And one thing I started to learn, and it was a bit of news to me, was that everybody in the Western tradition just assumed that the content of your thought is linguistic meaning. But if you then hold this view, you're committed to understanding others in terms of the outlook encoded in your language. And so I was able to just basically reconstruct the kinds of things that I was seeing in the scholarship in Indology by reference to this theory. And the funny thing about this theory is that when you read, you know, contemporary philosophers from, you know, the 20th century, they make it sound like it's a new thing, the linguistic turn, right? So Michael Dummett will talk about how Frege was the first to come to this idea. But it's really, it goes back to the Greeks who had one word for, you know, thought and language, logos. And so there's this huge tradition in the West where this basic model of understanding of language influences and informs the kinds of things that people who operate in this tradition are willing to say and what they're willing to count as understanding. So I don't mean to be too long-winded, I'll stop talking shortly. But one of the outcomes then, I think, of thinking about thought in terms of language is that you're committed to what's called interpretation, which is explanation by way of what you take to be true or you believe. And this is a really funny model of thought for two reasons. First of all, if you're committed to interpretation, you can never understand someone who disagrees with you because you're always committed to understanding them in terms of what you think is true. And then the second problem, which it took me a long time to realize, and no one has said this from what I could see, but this violates very basic expectations in logic, where good inference has nothing to do with truth. It has to do with the property of conclusions following from premises if they were true. That's very different than trying to understand a conclusion in terms of what you think is true, because good inferences might be comprised of premises that are false and a conclusion that's false, and you can have invalid inferences that are comprised entirely of true claims. So the emphasis on truth, or what you take to be true, is not only just kind of bizarre in terms of, you know, it undermines your capacity to understand those we disagree with, it's just basically irrational. It's the kind of thing that if you, you know, if a student in a critical thinking class where it was to affirm, they would be quickly disabused of that by their critical thinking professor. But yet it's kind of the basic view of the Western tradition. And I think of, you know, Indology as we understand it as this practice within the Western tradition that you have to understand, you know, what Indian philosophers and thinkers were saying in terms of what they or we think is true. And so that kind of brought me to where I was when I was asked by Chad Meister to contribute to this series. And I was a little reluctant because what I had to say, I thought, was going to be a bit subversive. But, you know, that was basically where I was when I picked up this project.
So let's somehow recap this rich survey of how you got here for a non-specialist or even a non-philosophy trained audience. Now, it sounds to me like you are you're conveying a disjunction between two conceptions of philosophy, or two systems of knowing, or when one says that, for example, you know, one doesn't see virtue ethics or certain kind of philosophical systems in India as with the West, it sounds to me like you are indicating almost incompatible modes of thought. Does this resonate?
Yeah, so I think so I agreed with the first half of your summary. And the first half of the summary is that there are two different ways that we could think about understanding, not philosophy. Only one's really compatible with philosophy. But there's two different ways that we can think about understanding, and partly, why this might not have been clear from what I said was I only talked about the problematic option, not the correct version. But the problematic option is to think that if I'm going to understand you, I have to understand you in terms of what I think is true. Right. And so the problems there, you know, and this could generalize, right? So if I had to operate with this, you know, a European background, intellectual background, when I operate with interpretation, I'm going to try and understand Indian thinkers in terms of what, people in the European tradition would have been willing to say. And so, if you do this, then you won't be open to new options, are new theories or disagreements between Indian philosophers and European intellectuals, because you're committed to only understanding whatever you're willing to agree with, right? And whatever you're willing to agree with will include your background assumptions and the like. And one of the things I point out in this book is that because this model of understanding in terms of what you take to be true comes out of this very Western model of thinking about thought in terms of language, then the historical reality of interpretation is that it operates politically with the background of Eurocentrism. It doesn't have to. You know, the world could have been different, and, you know, the linguistic theory of thought could have originated in India, in which case we'd all be interpreting with Indian assumptions now. But it's just a kind of accident of history that this model of thought was the default model of the Western tradition. And so then it creates a context where understanding can never allow for disagreement. So what's the alternative? The alternative is to understand in terms of valid inference. So this requires just a 30-second intro to logic lesson, which is, you know, one of the first things you learn if you take a critical thinking class or a formal logic class is that there are two different kinds of inferences. There are valid inferences, and then there are invalid inferences. And a valid inference is such that if the premises are true, the conclusion has to be true. So that's not the same as inferences where the premises are true, right? So you can think of lots of arguments with false premises, but if those premises were true, the conclusion would have to be true, right? So, like, you know, the moon is made out of green cheese. Premise one, green cheese is tasty. Conclusion, therefore, the moon is tasty. That's all false, but nevertheless, it's a valid inference, because if the premises were true, the conclusion would have to be true. So I think what we do in philosophy, and this is nothing that you can learn except for studying lots of philosophy, not just a little bit, but lots of philosophy, is that you're challenged to understand someone else as providing you an argument. And your only means of assessing that argument is in terms of validity. So you're going to try and figure out what premises they hold, such that if those premises were true, then the conclusions that they come to would have to be true. Now, I call this explication. This word explication has been used in other ways. But one of the things I point out is that this model is not only based on logic. It doesn't assume any background agreement, right? So, as a philosophy student, if I try to understand the Yoga Sutra, for instance, right, what I would have to do is I'd have to read the entire Yoga Sutra and then look for premises in the Yoga Sutra that entail the odd claims here and there that potentially makes about Dharma, right? And then once I've come to a theory that implicit in the text that would entail the claims that Patanjali is making about Dharma, I've understood Patanjali's theory of Dharma, right? This is the same thing we do when we're trying to understand Kant or Plato or whoever it may be. We're trying to look for the premises implicit in what, in the perspective that's being offered, that would entail the controversial claims. And then the second part of this process of explication is that once we've done this for a very large number of competing theories, we look at what the competing theories converge on as they disagree. So, you know, you have to study lots of ethical theories before you understand that what moral philosophers are disagreeing about is the right or the good. That's basically the one thing they have in common as they disagree. And so one of the things I point out is if you were to do the same to Indian philosophy, and you look darshana to darshana, and you look at the premises in each darshana that entail their particular claims about dharma, you find that what they have in common is that they're disagreeing about the right or the good. Okay, so there are then two very different ways that we could approach understanding what's common in the Western tradition and in Indology is interpretation, and what's really central to philosophy is this is what I call explication. And it just so happens that the Western tradition has from the very beginning had a very troubled relationship with philosophy, right? It starts with the murder of Socrates, and then you have this very long tradition of persecuting public intellectuals. And I think it's just because if you have this view that understanding has to be based on you know, what you believe, you're going to have a lot of trouble with disagreement. But if you adopt explication, then disagreement is really how you make sense of things. So those are kind of the two approaches.
Okay, so now that you've set the stage in terms of the backdrop, tell us about the book project. Tell us about what it is you want to share, the research question, or what is it you tackle in the book?
So one of the things that started appearing to me as salient is that once you've distinguished between these two methods of understanding and you also appreciate the historical roots of interpretation, then you have an explanation not only for why Indian philosophy is kind of studied the way it is, you know, in terms of what the Indologist thinks to be true. And so then as Indian philosophers' views on, say, morality or ethics depart from the Indologist, right, it simply isn't represented in the research. But you also have an explanation for something else, which is why anything in our world gets counted as religion, right? So, you know, I think for students of South Asia, it's pretty obvious that, especially Hinduism, that for any stereotype you have about what is religious or what counts as, you know, religious belief, you're going to find a South Asian or Hindu counterexample, right? So you can be a Hindu and an atheist. You can be a Hindu and a naturalist, right? The Sankhya Karika is this long, you know, exposition of a naturalist theory of the evolution of Prakriti, where even, you know, mentality and personality comes out to be this kind of epiphenomenal result of complexity. And, you know, the saving insight, according to the Sankhya Karika, is that, you know, you really understand what's true when you realize that, you know, the only thing that's ever made choices or suffered or gone through experiences has been nature. Right, so this is a very kind of strong naturalistic argument. It's almost an eliminativist argument for mentality or persons. And if you ran into a European articulating this with no non-European roots, everybody would just say, oh, it's, you know, something like secular naturalism. But the moment it's a South Asian, historically, you know, not drawing from the Western tradition, it becomes Hinduism. So, you know, what accounts for this bizarre double standard where, you know, a Western philosopher, say like Descartes or Plato, can talk about God, but that's secular philosophy. But the moment, you know, a historical South Asian talks about naturalism or atheism, that's got to be religion. And this distinction between explication and interpretation answers that question. It says that, well, the reasons we distinguish between secular thought in religion is because if you assume interpretation and a Eurocentric background, then anything that isn't derivable from European literature is going to be mysterious, difficult to explain. It's going to seem traditional and somehow kind of obstinately traditional in the face of not being overtly reasonable, right? In religion, the category of religion in our world is this box, where everything that isn't derivable from European literature and is hence not interpretable by, you know, the beliefs of the European tradition gets put in. And this is why all the major world religions are not of European origin, right? They all have their origin outside. And so Hinduism is a kind of very late addition to this schematism, where European literature is counted as secular, and then everything that's not interpretable by those standards is religion. Hinduism is kind of, it's one of the late arrivals on the scene, but it's, you know, in a way an extremely interesting version, because the context in which the category Hinduism is baptized, or, you know, its inaugural usage, is under British colonialism. And originally it was meant to just designate, you know, all indigenous Indian religion, and, you know, to the exclusion of Islam. So, you know, it seems that the Brit, you know, that they wanted, that the colonialists needed a way to kind of suss out what was indigenously South Asian. So I think that the category of Hinduism has this class membership rule of something like South Asian, no common founder. And this is a kind of peculiar category definition, because it's a class definition, not a kind definition. So a kind is a category where the members instantiate the criterion of membership. So the category of red will contain all red things, and every red thing will kind of display what it is to be red. But some categories are classes, like fruit salad, right? So, you know, the category fruit salad is a, you know, a collection of fruits, of pieces of different fruit. And, you know, the pieces of fruit salad don't necessarily display this, right? So a piece of fruit salad could be a piece of orange, and a piece of orange does not display itself to be composed of different kinds of fruit, right? And I think the category definition of Hinduism, in that it's a class and not a kind, leaves it absolutely open as to what could possibly fall within the category of Hinduism. So knowing that something is Hindu tells you nothing about what it's committed to. And I think this kind of peculiarity of Hinduism as a class and not a kind explains why Hinduism can seem extremely open, and almost anything can be, anything South Asian can be Hindu, but not vice versa, right? So, you know, given that class definition, you know, Islam or Christianity could be Hindu so long as they were kind of sufficiently South Asian. But because Christianity and Islam are kinds, where the group members have to instantiate some defining feature, you know, in Christianity is probably, you know, the priority of Jesus, and in Islam it will be Muhammad in the Quran, right? Given that there's a difference in the logic of the categories, right, you're going to find that, say, you know, if you won't be allowed to be, say, first a Christian and then a Hindu, but it could work the other way. So what does this tell us then about Hinduism? So one of the things I argue then is that, well, given that it's really so open-ended, and the only reason we call it a religion is because it's just not interpretable by the tradition of the West, we should really just try to understand Hinduism in terms of its disagreements. But how are you going to do that except for adopting the methodology of understanding philosophical disagreements? And if we do that, we find that the only reasonable way to represent Hinduism is in terms of what we converge on as we disagree in philosophy. And the only caveat I put in is that if we're going to do this, we should use South Asian resources to represent Hinduism. The upside, though, is that if we can say something sensible about what we converge on when we disagree philosophically, we're not only saying something interesting about Hinduism, we're also saying something interesting about philosophy.
So the notion that Hinduism is this catch-all umbrella for various Indian South Asian practices that have accrued over millennia, this idea that it's, you know, it's more of a group of things than a thing. This resonates. Would you say there are no defining features to what we call Hinduism to this day?
So I think that it really depends upon what method of understanding you adopt. So if you're a committed interpreter, you'll be committed to, you know, finding out some type of basic commitment that Hindus share by virtue of being Hindus, right? And so I distinguish the kind of Hinduism I'm interested in talking about. I call that representative Hinduism, where we represent the disagreements of Hinduism, with South Asian resources. We can think of a comprehensive form of Hinduism where, you know, the author really stipulates or says, well, look, in order to be Hindu, you have to endorse X, Y, and Z. And the reason that anybody would engage in that kind of activity is that they're committed to this idea that good explanations have to be explanations in terms of what you take to be true. So if you're committed to that, I think you would be committed to finding something or I think really making something up. Now, the reason why I think that you're forced to confabulate is that you're going to have to cherry pick, because you're going to have to decide what it is you think is central to Hinduism. And then you're going to have to, once you've done that, you're going to draw a line between the things you're willing to consider within and the things that fall outside of your view. And I think that's a very common approach. I think interpretation is such a basic practice in the world, in the Westernized world, that people are really driven to that. And you can find extreme versions of this, you know, in kind of nationalist projects. But you can also find, you know, the idea that Hinduism is a very tolerant religion that's open to, you know, all paths leading to the same goal. You know, I think it's an attempt to find something central to Hinduism that Hindus are going to be committed to by virtue of being Hindus. So what I argue is that because this is really just a function of the methodology that we're already committed to, we should ask the question of which methodology is more reasonable to adopt. And since interpretation or explanation by way of what you take to be true just violates these very basic expectations of logic, I say, well, let's just think about what we find when we're open to disagreement, right? And so I think if you follow the approach that I recommend, you kind of walk away from that question of whether there's anything central to Hinduism, because you see that you see the need or the need to answer that question as a result of a bad methodology. But the upshot of, I think, is that if you account for Hinduism as this disagreement, you leave it open, which means that you can't easily draw boundaries, and you also have to give up trying to understand what Hindus believe by virtue of being Hindus.
All right. Now that we are clear on the undergirding ideology of the book, what is your research question? What is the main thing you're probing?
Well, I mean, I guess I'm probing the question of what does reasonable or rational research look like in a world where the West has already exerted this remarkable amount of imperialism. And that remarkable amount of imperialism, I think, is just reducible to a really wacky theory of thought, which says that thought is linguistic meaning. That's to confuse the thinkable with what's culturally encoded. And because that has a European history, as that theory of thought spreads and, you know, the non-Western is divided up into, you know, it's parsed out as religious, etc., people buy, without ever a moment's of reflection or hesitation, this idea that, well, if we really are going to engage in something like research, we should be in the business of talking about what's true, right? And I think, you know, the question of, well, what does reasonable research look like in a world where we don't want, you know, when we recognize the imperialism of the West, you know, there's two ways you could go about this, which, you know, the one way is the more common way, which is you don't really criticize the underlying assumptions of the West. And when I talk about West in the book, I distinguish this orthographic distinction, right? There's kind of just a geographic fact of being Western, like I am now, small W West. And then I think of this tradition, and I mark it out with a slanted and italic W, capital italic W, leaning on the EST. You know, the pun is, it's the West that leans on the East. But I think that the moment you acknowledge that there is this tradition, and it does have a culturally peculiar way of thinking about thought and understanding that's just kind of exploded into global imperialism, that it's implausible to think that the right way to go about understanding anything is just understanding in terms of, you know, what people believe and what they take to be true. So, you know, the question is, well, how would we engage in a kind of serious scholarship that wasn't kind of not only irrational because it depends on interpretation, but politically suspect because, you know, it's just kind of culturally biased. And I think the answer is that, well, we have to look to philosophy. Philosophy is something that allows us to disagree, but I think one of the peculiar outcomes of this project for me was that when I started to understand Hinduism this way, the South Asian tradition became an alternative to the paradigm of the West, right? So whereas in the West, you do have this pull towards belief and culture and language as the locus of thought and convergence. And so understanding then is about agreement, right? In South Asia, I found that the more I tried to understand philosophically the potential of this tradition, the more I saw it as a tradition that was just open to disagreement as the way we understand. And I have a bit more to say about that, but I'll stop
So before I dig into some of the sections of the book, let me ask you, 30,000 foot view, what is the theme, what is the takeaway you most hope readers take away? Right.
Yeah, so I think that, so I guess there's two sides of the positive theme. I think when we, you know, if we really want to be reasonable and kind of avoid interpretation and simply explaining in terms of what we believe, we have to accept objectivity. And objectivity isn't the same as what we could agree to. It's what we converge on when we disagree, right? And I think the South Asian tradition has these lovely metaphors and symbols for like the conch that Vishnu holds, right? It's a perfectly asymmetrical object. And what's interesting about a conch is that it looks different from every perspective, but yet it's the same thing. So the object of the conch then plays a central role in accounting for our disagreements, right? And another analogy I use is the distinction between a mirror and a reflection. We know that a mirror is objective because when we look at it from different perspectives, we describe it differently. But the mirror is what's holding down the disagreement, right? And the reflection in the mirror is just subjective. It all depends on your perspective. And so when we're thinking about intellectual history, but also philosophy in the wide sense of all the topics that we could be interested in, right? Lots of folks assume that there's nothing objective there because they've confused philosophy with interpretation, which is just kind of explaining in terms of your beliefs. But when we appreciate what objectivity is, that it really plays a central role in disagreement, then we need a completely different paradigm for thinking about thought and understanding. And one of the themes of the book then are these themes from yoga end up playing a central role, yoga as discipline. You know, when we're interested in academic research, it has to be, you know, it's grounded in disciplinarity. But what is disciplinarity, right? Well, disciplinarity is a practice that you can engage in from multiple perspectives, and it allows you to triangulate on objects of inquiry, right? And so the importance then of yoga, of disciplinarity, to research, I think, is central. But it just completely, you know, once we start going down that route, a lot of the political baggage that comes with the West just goes out of the window. So if we assume that thought is linguistic meaning, right, not only do we end up confusing the thinkable with what we believe, what's culturally encoded in our perspective, but, you know, we start thinking that the only things that can think are humans because you need language to think. And then you'll have, you know, not only humans, but, you know, the only ones that you can get along with are the ones in your community, which is why, you know, the West has been kind of famous for trying to colonize the world, because that's the only way that you could have a conversation with someone if you're committed to this kind of bizarre view that thought is ultimately just this linguistic phenomenon, right? You have to force people to be part of your community to even have a conversation with them on this view. But the moment we realize how irrational that entire paradigm is, right, I think the anthropocentrism starts to go away, the communitarianism starts to go away, and we start to get interested in research as something that reveals to us objects of inquiry. So that's kind of, I think, the bigger philosophical takeaway. But I also do think that, you know, from a religious studies perspective, you know, one of the things that comes through is that we have a lot to learn about how the way forward by thinking about Indian and Hindu resources.
Was there a chapter that was most meaningful to you?
I think the chapter on logic ended up being kind of symbolic.
Chapter 4.
Yes. So it's called Logic, the Nectar of Immortality.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a lot of people think about logic in terms of just rules and systems. And, you know, that it's true when you study logic, you're going to study differing systems of inference, etc. But when you think about the topic of logic as something objective, right, it has to be framed not in terms of differing perspectives, but something that you can converge on as you disagree, right? So then to inquire into logic objectively, there has to be a way to formalize this inquiry such that we could all be engaged in this disagreement about reasons and all the same be converging on something objective about reasons. And so the story I use there, so this chapter was a little different. So in other chapters, like my chapter on ethics and the chapter on epistemology, it's a large survey. So one of the things I try to show is that, you know, in the chapter on ethics, whereas most religions are reducible to a specific ethical theory, when we come to Hinduism, it's got the full span of possibilities. And the same in epistemology. And I try to show, you know, across the board that you can't really, it's just historically inaccurate to reduce, you know, what Hindus have to say about any philosophical topic to a specific theme. But in this chapter, you know, I just found myself drawn to the story of the churning of the milk ocean as a kind of allegory for how Hindus can think about reason in a public world, right? So, you know, I'm sure a lot of us are familiar with the story. You know, the gods seem to have lost their status because of some type of controversy they were cursed, or, you know, however you could get the controversy off the ground. And then they go to Vishnu, and Vishnu says, well, you know, I've got a plan, but, you know, this involves you having to conscript the help of the Asuras, who are their kind of mortal enemies. And, you know, the Asuras aren't as a category all bad, you know, like Varuna, Justice, and Mitra are in ancient texts called Asuras. But I think one thing that Asuras have in common is that they're kind of intolerant of diverse perspectives. So we're okay with that in the case of justice, right? We don't want to tolerate injustice and friendliness. We don't want to tolerate in unfriendliness. But the Asuras, the way that they're described, they're really just in it for themselves. So anyways, they all agree to work together because the prize is the nectar of immortality. If they can churn this ocean, they'll be able to get it. And so, of course, you know, Vishnu turns into a turtle or tortoise, and they churn. They use his back. He submerges himself in the ocean. He uses his back. And then, you know, this king of snakes ends up being the rope. And then there's this, you know, divine mountain that ends up being kind of the churning device. And so then they have to go back and forth to churn the ocean. And, you know, one of the things that struck me about this story is that it's an allegory for understanding validity, right? So when we're trying to make sense of validity, a valid argument, we're trying to understand an argument from a third person perspective that we might not agree with. And yet we somehow understand the force of the argument. Right. And so it so happens in this, you know, the story that they're churning back and forth, and everybody's has to kind of give in to the force. You know, they have to acknowledge the force of their opponent, but they don't actually thereby have to agree. Right. So that's kind of the churning. And, you know, rather magically, it happens on the back of Vishnu, who is a turtle, and, you know, withdrawing the limbs is a metaphor in Indian philosophical text for withdrawing your senses. And so a turtle is an animal that can withdraw its limbs. And so the fact that they're churning on the back of a turtle, right, all the more, you know, symbolizes this activity of logic or reasoning where it's not a sensory exercise. You're really trying to understand the force of a third party without having to give in. So, you know, this ends up just, you know, taking a central thematic note in this chapter. And I noticed that, you know, what's interesting about this model compared to the views articulated by famous logicians, philosophers who are logicians or were logicians, you know, people like Frege or even Husserl, who tried it, his hand, or Mill, who was kind of famous for logic in his day, and Heidegger also wrote on logic, is that all of these kind of contemporary figures had all of these xenophobic and racist views. And it's often difficult for us as students of philosophy to reconcile, their contributions on logic with their bizarre political views. But I think that's because in the Western tradition, we don't think about reason as trying to engage with disagreement, right? From the various earliest times, you find Plato talking about reason as the part of the soul that loves the truth. And so in the Western tradition, truth ends up being really central. But if truth is central, then, people who don't see things the way you do become a problem. And people with, different backgrounds are not going to share your perspective, and so they're going to seem like a threat. But what's interesting about this model from the myth is that you really have to learn how to get along with those who disagree if you want the prize of immortality. And, and it so happens in the story that the Asuras, they renege on their bet, and Vishnu ends up choosing those who know how to disagree. But, this is an interesting, moral, right? That what it is to be divine is to be able to, understand those you disagree with and put up with them in a way that the Asuras weren't willing to. And so that, to me, kind of ended up being emblematic of this theme I started seeing in Hinduism, that, at some point, in some way, you have to just learn to get along with those you don't see eye to eye with.
Yeah, it's a very powerful myth, one that I've used many times before to think about.
Right.
Yeah, I've used it a number of times. So your use of it was very interesting to me, actually. How do you make of the fact that the gods actually end up tricking the demons for their purposes?
Well, I'm not sure if they were really, so I think one of the interesting features about thinking about disagreement is that truth stops being so important. And in the Western tradition, this is horrible. And there are some kind of claims in the Indian tradition where truth, satya, vada, dharmacharya, truth ends up being kind of this very important thing. But when you look at, say, the Yama rules, which we find in the ancient Jain tradition and later in the Yoga Sutra, right? Truth doesn't come first. It's ahimsa. And that, I never quite appreciated that until I started thinking about what was involved in reasoning. That is, if I really want to understand someone, I have to put aside the question of what I take to be true and somehow put up with them and then find a way to coexist with them. And then after I've done that, a certain truth emerges, and the truth is about what we can disagree about. And I think this is what logic, at a deep level really teaches us, that when we're understanding an inference, it's not about how we see the world. It's about what follows from a certain set of assumptions. But in order to get to this inside of a reason, you have to be willing to put up with those you don't agree with. So, in the versions that I'm familiar with, I'm not sure that tricking the Asuras was ever very salient, but I would say this. I think that if you're concerned about understanding those you don't agree with, you're not really under any obligation to be honest. And this is a theme that comes up in other kind of Vaishnava stories where Krishna will just kind of lie, but for a good result. And, as I've kind of gotten older and I've started thinking more and more about reason, I see that, well, yes, right? If you were really convinced that interpretation was the right way to go about things, then honesty becomes a big issue. You really have to be truthful. But if understanding those you disagree with is really more important, then honesty stops being so much of an issue, right? And that's because if I can get those I disagree with, if I can understand them, sure, I'm being maybe manipulative in some way, but it's actually better for everybody. It's more reasonable for everybody. And the alternative is, if I think that truth is really important, not only do I act kind of irrationally, because truth isn't really essential to being reasonable in any way, but I really end up prioritizing myself, right? I make myself and my perspectives are really the most important thing. It's a bizarre kind of ego trip. So I don't know. I tend to be rather unsympathetic with these kinds of instances of manipulation, where, you know, the goal is to allow for a diversity of perspectives.
So the churning of the ocean myth, I've used a number of times in different contexts, both in workshops for continuing studies and for public consumption, and also in world religions, sort of teaching Hinduism contexts. It is an extraordinarily rich myth that it never ceases to amaze me, the ways in which it can be interpreted, because it's one of these myths that encompass sort of the largest themes of life. Tell us, what are you working on now? What's the next step?
Yeah, so at the moment I'm working on a project that I call Ethics a Global Approach is kind of the working title. And, you know, it really comes off of the tail of the work I've been doing specifically on India, right? So prior to this book, I edited the Bloomsbury Research Handbook on Indian Ethics, and there was another large project on Indian ethics I was involved in. And so now I'm kind of interested in formulating, you know, an argument about thinking about disagreement as central to moral understanding. And so this is a lesson that I kind of draw from thinking about Hinduism, thinking about philosophy and what it is to understand others. And so I contrast it with, you know, what I would call a parochial way of going about things, where you try to understand everything in terms of your perspective. And that, you know, that's how we get contemporary Indology, where, you know, when an Indian philosopher or thinker uses a philosophical term, with very rare exceptions, the knee-jerk reaction isn't to try to understand the theory that the thinker is operating with that would lead to these kinds of claims, right? The knee-jerk reaction is to just substitute what the Indian thinker is saying with what you would have preferred to have said in that case. You know, at a related point, Donald Davidson, a rather famous philosopher of language, you know, riffing on this theme, talked about, you know, the case of people where they misspeak, right? And he's got Archie Bunker as the example, when Archie Bunker says, you know, we need a few laughs to break up the monogamy, right? It's a kind of funny thing that he says, but the question is, well, how do we understand him, right? And Davidson says, you know, he's operating with these kind of background assumptions in the Western tradition. Well, you just say what you would have said in that case. You just assume he's talking about what you would have said, which is not monogamy, but monotony, right? And that's the appropriate response to someone who misspoke, right? But it seems like an entirely inappropriate response when you're trying to understand Indian thinkers or other philosophers to treat them as though they misspoke, right? That you would simply just substitute what you would prefer they said for what they said. And I think this kind of inclination to judge everything from our own vantage as though it's a kind of necessary starting point is part of this very basic commitment to a parochial approach to life, right? Where all the evidence has to be assessed from our perspective. And so I'm interested in this idea that, well, why don't we just think about moral inquiry as the attempt to just understand disagreement? And so, you know, it's a project that draws from the European, the Chinese, and the Indian tradition equally, at least ideally. But, you know, the idea then would be that we would come to a way of thinking moral inquiry where we weren't assuming that our background was the kind of the unique or necessary starting point. And I think what will end up happening as I kind of pursue this question is that we'll end up with conclusions that are somewhat consonant with a yogic outlook, right? With an outlook where disciplinarity ends up being central, but we also have to allow for diversity of a diversity of perspectives, and that objectivity, right, what we converge on as we disagree, is a kind of fixed point in inquiry. And if we can treat that as somehow fixed, we'll have a way of understanding what's really true in these topics. And what's really true sheds light on the possibilities of disagreement and the values that we need. So that's what I'm working on at the moment.
That sounds like very interesting research. And it seems that we have taken enough of your time for one day.
Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. We have been talking with Shyam Ranganathan from the Department of Philosophy at York University in Toronto on his 2018 Routledge publication, Hinduism, a Contemporary Philosophical Investigation. Thank you very much, Shyam.
Thanks, Raj.